I assume that what Walter Pilgrim has just been talking about is the problem of living in the city. I have only one other comment to make about the problem of language. Several years ago, my family and I spent a sabbatical in Heidelberg, and my German, I can read it, but my hearing of it and speaking of it is nearly non-existent. It happened the spring before we went to Heidelberg that I was preaching a college baccalaureate in the morning, and in the afternoon, the ambassador from West Germany to the United States was the commencement speaker. So I preached in the morning, and then we had lunch together, and I told him that I was going to Heidelberg, and he asked me if I was going to teach over there, and I said, indeed not, my language is not good enough. And then I knew why he was an ambassador, because he said to me, well, you do very well in your own language. I want to begin by thanking you for your responsiveness and for your receptiveness to my talking a much better game than I play. And I would be remiss if I did not, before I leave, say to those of you who are Missouri Synod Lutherans that the struggle in which you are engaged for the freedom and the power of the gospel unfettered in the city is a matter of enormous concern to many of us who are not Lutherans. And those of you who stand with people like Dr. Jake, it is important for those of us who are not Lutherans to say to you that we care mightily, and we give thanks to God for you, and we make intercession daily for you. Now I have some more random thoughts on water baptism. I presume it is indeed the leading of the Spirit that led us to have the theme of bread and wine this morning. Because of all of the mosaic things that are re-entered at the boundary, this morning I want to talk about the wilderness memory of Egypt, of Israel. That when Israel went again to the boundary, she knew that she had to look both ways, that we may know in our bones that we are children of both, that we are children of the land with all of its security and its management, and we are children of the wilderness with all of its precariousness. And we are always both of those, with both of those histories. But Israel knew very well and was very clear that of these two histories, it is the history of the wilderness that is the first history, and it is the deepest history, and which has shaped our consciousness long before it was reshaped by the land for the city. And so at the boundary, Israel re-enters this history of precariousness, which is so important to us if we are to understand our nature and mission. And so the preacher at the boundary says these things, Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, he humbled you and he let you hunger, and he fed you with manna which you did not know and which your fathers did not know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but that man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out upon you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Or in Deuteronomy 8, verse 15, he who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of flint rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you. Or in Deuteronomy 7:9-7, remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you came out of Egypt until you came to this place have you been rebellious against Yahweh. These texts provide two very different images of the wilderness memory. The first one is likely earlier, and it is about surprising nourishment. And the second one, which is probably later, is about terrible rebellion. And that is the character of our common life with God, of surprising nourishment and terrible rebellion, about his extravagant goodness and our grudging obedience in that first moment of freedom. And my impression is that the city would have us forget both, that we have been terribly rebellious and that we have been amazingly nourished. And we go to the boundary so that we do not forget precisely what the city wants us to forget. My impression about a lot of recent liberation theology is that it has been almost a theology of glory. It has been triumphalist in its orientation. It has been singularly about the Exodus, about the marvelous liberation and the defeat of Pharaoh, and we shall overcome. It is likely that liberation theology, at least in the flesh pots of America, must be nurtured and nourished primarily by the wilderness memory. It is the wilderness that is the central arena for freedom after the Exodus. It is the wilderness that is the scandal of the gospel. It is a scandal for liberals who have, at least in their rhetoric, gone from strength to strength. And it is a scandal to conservatives who have laid it all on his cross and none of ours. And I sense what is happening to that theology in the 60s, in the 70s, is that we are having to quit trying to be the Exodus church, and we are having to ask what it means to be the wilderness people, which I suppose is expressed dramatically in Moltmann's writing, which moves in a dialectic pattern from a theology of hope to the crucified God, from the victorious power of God to the exposed powerlessness of God. And that may be the urgent question at the boundary for his people who have been too vigorously the church in power. Israel never wanted freedom. And there is sufficient evidence to know that she was stunned when she left slavery. That is, when she became disengaged from the public order for the sake of an alternative. And then she had to look at the fine print that you never look at the moment of the Exodus. And sure enough, it said, 40 years in the wilderness. So I want to suggest that maybe the wilderness is the central paradigm for the faith of the church in the 70s, when we are indeed not flexing our muscles of power. Wilderness is a place of extreme precariousness. It is a place where we seem to be without resources, and if I may say so, even without a plan. And the task of faithfulness is inordinately demanding. It is no wonder that in the wilderness there was restlessness and there was bitching, and there was, if you will forgive the word, schism, and there was even a little leprosy. And I suppose what the wilderness is about is to find out how serious we were about all of our talk about faith alone. Wilderness is a place of vulnerability where you feel exposed to the elements and alone and abandoned and without defense, and no one honors our identity and no one takes us seriously, and we are helpless to have our own way with our own life. Here there is no heady complacency about letting the world set the agenda, because the desert has already set the agenda, and the agenda in the desert is always death. And I suppose that wilderness is the place where Isaiah 53, that fourth servant song, is always recited, because it is the church in the wilderness that is always without form and comeliness, not esteemed and rejected by people who cannot bear to look upon it. So the text I want to talk about is the text that we read this morning, pieces of Exodus 16. It is the story of manna, and it is learning to pray daily for bread. And I have been asking about me and about the people I know and about the church, about how it could be that people like us could in fact pray daily for bread. And I have been asking about what happens to people like us who live in the land, who always know where our next meal is coming from, and who seldom pray, and when we pray, it is surely not daily, and it is certainly not for bread. And Deuteronomy called the elder Israel to the boundary in wonderment, that may be wonder bread, about what happens to the church in the land when the church eats and eats and eats and then is full, and what can a satiated church do? And surely questions of the nature of the church will be answered in terms of fullness and not hunger. And the question of the mission of the church will be answered in terms of getting more bread. And we will contrive theological and pious rationalizations about not living by bread, when in fact we do live by bread. We live by bread so much that we can scarcely hear the voice of God that is in the bread. And so our mothers and fathers had the courage of freedom, and they disengaged from the satiation of Egypt, from the insanity called normalcy, and they learned precisely what we fear. And that is, when you disengage the flesh pots, you get hungry. And they learned to pray daily for bread. But we must not be misled about their praying daily for bread. Their prayer for daily bread is not a pious prayer. It is a desperate, indignant, angry prayer. It is an urgent prayer by a church which had promised to live only by what he gave. And then they, like us, began to ask and have doubts about whether he gave anything. And so the prayer is a complaint. It is a complaint which takes hunger most seriously and which takes Yahweh most seriously, and asks and insists that he do something about hunger. And I have been wondering about me, who eat so well, about how hungry I would have to be before I prayed with that kind of passion. And the story makes this strange disclosure that our mothers and fathers were betwixt Egypt and wilderness, and they looked to Egypt and they drooled at the meat there. And then the text says this remarkable thing that was read this morning. And then they looked to the wilderness, and there they saw the glory of Yahweh. They did not see him when they looked toward Egypt. They saw him only when they looked toward the wilderness, when they looked in the direction of vulnerability. Yahweh, they discovered, is the one who had undone Pharaoh and who is to be found only in the place of precariousness. And Dr. Tillichy said so well last night that we are not dealing with a capricious God, but we are dealing with a God who is in character in the wilderness. I think this text means to suggest to us that his natural habitat is in the wilderness, that he is always at the moment of vulnerability, and he only asks his people to be where he is, where he normally is, without resources, exposed and defenseless, having put distance between himself and the legitimacy of Egypt and the efficacy of Egyptian techne. And the church is having to learn that the one to whom we pray daily for bread is the one who has submitted himself to the dangers of the wilderness, that God himself is not interested in establishment satiation. And I guess finally, again, it is a question of the character of God, that we learn about him who he is, and we learn of him and to him only under conditions of wilderness. And I do not know what that means, but it at least means that we must engage in some very heavy imagination. about our common destiny. So they pray daily for bread, and it is given. It is not given in Egypt where bread is natural, but it is given in the wilderness at the point of precariousness where no one thought it would be given. It is given in ways that will not be programmed or predicted or replicated. It is given in ways that call into question our best technical reason. And last night I talked about the shattering of our urban rationality, and here it is, that the way this bread is given suggests that we must take care that we do not know too much. And how do we in the city, which is what our speaker was talking about this morning, how do we face up to the gift of bread when we own the bakery? And we do own the bakery. So we have some very difficult imagining to do about the gift bread that is among us, that gives us life. And the second miracle of the text is not only that bread is given, but the heavy miracle of how the bread is distributed. And you know how it is distributed. Many gathered much, and some gathered very little, and all had exactly what they needed, and none had more than they needed. That's not capitalism, and it's not socialism, and it's not Marxism. It is a violation of our rationality. It is a vision of the strange irrationality of the kingdom. And we are invited to live those kind of unreasonable lives. What this text suggests to me is that this bread is unimpressed by coercion and competition. It is unimpressed by competence. And it is unimpressed by production, which is the myth that we have bought into in the city. This is bread which is given without reference to utility. And those without social utility got their bread too. And that's not the way it is in the land, because in the land, social utility counts. And now our most precious norms are declared insane. And the people of Israel gathered some more, some less. He who gathered much had none left over, and he who gathered little lacked nothing, and each got what he could eat. Now I think we need to let that rattle around in our heads. What it suggests to me is that people who pray daily for bread are committed to sociological nonsense. And that may be the foolishness of preaching, that to pray daily for bread is to be committed to a vision of social order that is nonsensical. This story acts like competence doesn't count. And very many of us in this room have spent our whole life becoming competent. And we really are. And the story acts like power doesn't count. And our mothers and fathers were in the radical fix of having to think about the nourishment rights of the least, the nourishment rights of the little ones who sociologically and politically and economically have been declared non-existent. They have no rights and they have no duties and they have no recorded glory. Now, as you know, like me, who does plan to leave early, our mothers and fathers in the wilderness were not saints, and they couldn't leave this alternative arrangement alone. They had to tamper with it because they had a better idea. And their better idea, it was a Canaanite idea. They wanted to store it up. They wanted to secure their own existence. They wanted to build a hedge against tomorrow. And the narrator doesn't want us to miss the point. So the words tumble out and he says, what happens to bread that is stored up? It got worms and it got foul and it melted. I don't know whether all those things can happen to bread, but you can pick any one of them and it will do. Now I have been thinking about storing up wilderness bread. And I want to store up wilderness bread because I do not want to pray daily for bread, because to pray daily for bread commits me to sociological nonsense, and I have not yet lost my social utility. There is another kind of bread in the Bible. In addition to wilderness bread, there is royal bread. It is the bread landed people eat who own their own bakeries. Of course, it is better to have bread daily from your bakery than it is to need to pray daily for bread. Which reminds me of this man that learned to bake a loaf of bread, and he sliced it very carefully, and he sold it, and people liked it so much that he would bake two loaves at a time, and he got a longer knife, and he cut two loaves at a time and sold it. But there was such demand that after a while he cut three loaves at a time, and he got a longer knife, and he cut through three loaves and sold it. And the demand increased to where he wanted to cut four loaves at a time, but he couldn't find a knife long enough, so he used a cleaver to cut it, and that's the beginning of the four-loaf cleaver. Sorry. Now, what I mean to be suggesting simply is that the Christian community consists in people who must live always between wilderness bread and royal bread. And we are always people who are seduced into thinking that we really do own an adequate bakery. And the hint of the gospel from time to time is that we do not live by royal bread, but we live by gift bread. And Paul puts this hard question to us, which is the central question for the church in the city: what do you have that you haven't been given? And I don't think that's a terribly weighty theological idea that's secret to us. It's just kind of common sense. And I've been assessing that in my life. And I really have a lot of this world's goods and a lot of influence and all those kinds of things that we crave. And I have nothing that really matters except gifts that are given to me and promises that are made to me and words that are spoken to me day by day. But in my insanity, every day I fall into the trap of saying this other stuff is really the basis out of which I will live. So the Bible sets up this marvelous contrast between royal bread and wilderness bread. And I want to give you two texts to look at sometime. I assume that you've been reading in Leviticus a lot. In Leviticus 26:26, there is a curse pronounced. And it is echoed in Hosea 4:10. The prophets read Leviticus. And both of them said, this is the curse on the people of God. They shall eat and eat and not be satisfied. And that is the curse of royal bread. And that is the curse of consumer society, that we produce and we consume in the midst of insatiable appetites. And we are not fed and we are not satisfied. And we sang that scandalous line this morning, feed me till I want no more. And I heard William Sloan Coffin, you may have seen the interview, he said there's only two ways to have enough. And one way is to keep getting more. And the other way is not to want so much. And it is a central question in the city about how shall we ever be fed, so that the cry of more can turn into the doxology of enough. And that is a theological question that the church can raise in the midst of a production-consumption city. And those two texts from Leviticus 26 and Hosea 4 drove me directly to the other text that our preacher read this morning from Isaiah 55. Come and buy without money and without price, and why do you hustle for stuff that won't nourish you? And it is exceedingly important that that text from Isaiah 55 is only articulated to God's people in the wilderness. Maybe that's the only place where that kind of text can ever be articulated. Now, I have said to you that one of the problems is amnesia, and we go to the boundary to remember. I have said to you that one of the problems is insanity, and we go to the boundary for a vision of sanity. And now, thirdly, I want to say that in this mix of royal bread and wilderness bread, that the central problem in the city is apathy. I do not mean apathy in the way that college newspaper editors always have an editorial in the spring about nobody coming to pep rallies. But I mean apathos. I mean the place where we have gotten in the city where we are incapable of feeling and incapable of caring and incapable of suffering redemptively. And I do know about me and about people like me that people who eat royal bread every day become apathetic. That people who live their lives out of royal bread know finally that there is nothing going on which keeps the human spirit alive, that there is nothing left except managing the bakeries. And that finally is very numbing work. And so the promise of the gospel is that we do not need to run a bakery like Pharaoh, and we do not need to run a bakery like Solomon, and we do not need to run a bakery like Herod. But the only way to get free of that numbing vocation is to pray daily for wilderness bread. The alternative to the apathy of the city, of course, is pathos. And we have a double use of the word passion. Passion means to feel strongly, means to care deeply. But we also use the word passion, do we not, for that strange pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to the city, to die for the sake of the city. And I suppose one of the reasons we even have the passion narrative about Jesus is that he never quite got caught in royal bread, but he always prayed daily for wilderness bread on the way to the city. And so one of the agendas for the Christian congregation at the boundary is whether we can really get into the vision of what might be and the terror of what can be. And I am convinced in my own life that my capacity to be a man of passion or an apathetic man largely depends on what I eat. And the text in Exodus 16 goes on to talk about the problem of the Sabbath. The problem of the Sabbath is only a problem in the city for people who eat royal bread, and they could scarcely keep from gathering on the Sabbath because the city believes that the world will collapse unless we hustle every day. The Sabbath is the last sign of justification by grace. And I heard Abraham Heschel, that great rabbi, that great poet. He has a book that he wrote in the 30s on the Sabbath, and I commend it to you. But he said, the Sabbath is the one day in my life when I do not need to prove to anybody that I am a good rabbi. Now, there are no days in the city when we don't have to prove something to somebody about us. Now, there are no days in the city when we don't have to prove something to somebody about us. And it is a scandal of the Sabbath for urban men and women to discover that the world will not disintegrate if we take a break from our bakery for one day. So I am urging that one of the agendas for the church is to recover the power of the Sabbath. And you know that the prophet Amos, since Walter Pilgrim asked me to talk about the prophets, I will refer to one here in these closing moments. You know, Amos does a critique of the urban consciousness, and in chapter 8, he says that you can't wait for the Sabbath to be over so that the marketplace can open again so you can cheat people some more. And the Sabbath has to do with our leaving off of having to exploit people. So I find it compelling that in the midst of this story about bread, our mothers and fathers recognized Sabbath. And you know where that story in Exodus 16 ends. I suppose that some priest went through and put a little priestly thing at the end of every text. But where it ends up is that you get yourself a jar of manna, and you seal it up, and you carry it with you everywhere. That jar is never to be opened, because if you did, it would probably go, or it would smell badly. But it is for carrying into the city so that the sons and the daughters of wilderness do not forget how you are finally fed and satisfied. And I want to suggest to you that one of the tasks of the pastor is to help the Christian family and the Christian congregation locate jars of manna that can be carried among us. But you know how it is in the city. We must travel light. And we get promoted and moved by our companies. We call that the placement system. And one of the things you can't carry with you is the luxury of a jar of manna. And the more we eat royal bread, the more we forget the jar of manna. So some comments about Jesus. It is clear to me in the tradition of Mark, and I think in the others also, that the framers of the two feeding miracles in Mark 6 and Mark 8 clearly and consciously mean to be suggesting that here in Jesus, the amazing nourishment of the wilderness is happening over again. The language is very clear and very self-conscious about that, because the disciples say, "How shall we feed all these people in the wilderness?" Jesus has the capacity to turn the wilderness to which we have committed ourselves into a place of joyous nourishment with enough baskets of food left over for all the tribes of the house of Israel. And then there is that strange reflective comment in Mark 8 beginning at verse 14. Jesus, or the Markan narrator, knew about action, reflection, learning, and it's no good to have an experience if you don't reflect on it. There must be some humor in that text in Mark 8:14, because it says, they were with Jesus, but they had forgotten the bread. Now, they either forgot the bread because they believed him so much, or because they were confused. But the narrator means to say, the church is always caught with Jesus without bread. And the first thing Jesus says to his disciples is, beware of the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. Beware of establishment bread. Beware of royal bread. Beware of the bread of the city. Because a hungry community will eat anything it can get its hands on. Beware of the bread in which there is no word. Beware of the bread which can make no promises and cannot keep them. And that's a very important agenda for the church, because we have gotten very close to liking the taste of the bread of Herod. And then Jesus engages in this reflective activity and he asks them a series of questions. And he says, do you understand? Do you see what's been going on here? Do you know? Are your hearts hard? And they just sit there in a stupor because they don't know what to ask. And he had read Comenius and he knows that if you can't answer complex questions, you got to go to more simple questions. So he said, okay, I'll ask you some, every good teacher asks you some questions you know how to answer. Question number one. How many baskets of food was left over when I fed 5,000 people? They said, I know that. And the answer is 12. He said, oh, very good. They're still at the concrete operational stage. Question number two. How many baskets of food were left over when I fed the 4,000? I know that too. The answer is 4,000. Four. Or is it seven? Seven. 4,007. Okay. Jesus really wasn't interested in numbers. And he said, that's very good. Now, third question. Do you mean you still don't understand? And that's where it ends. Because they didn't. The church has a very difficult time moving beyond the concrete operational stage to understand what anything means. And that's a marvelous text for a preacher because it doesn't say what he wanted to understand, so you can put anything in there. But surely he wanted them to understand that the royal bread of the theology of glory will not feed anybody finally. And the only bread that will feed anybody is the wilderness bread of the cross. And that bread will nourish people in the city. We need look no further for the scandal of the gospel than the scandal which affirms that the bread of the wilderness will feed people when the bread of the king will not. And there is one other text. It's a strange text, and if I knew more about the redaction criticism, I would say something clever to you about it. It is in Mark 6:52, and it's just there by itself. We've had the feeding at the first of chapter 6, and then he goes on to other stuff, and it's like the narrator said, oh, one other thing I want in here real quick. And what the text says is they could not understand the bread because their hearts were hard. That's a very enigmatic statement. But if you remember the history of the phrase hardness of heart, you know it goes right back to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh can't ever understand the bread. The city nurtures us to have hard hearts. Did you read the incredible statement by the vice president in Texas the other day? Mr. Rockefeller, who was extolling the free market system, and we are co-opted into that, in which he said one of the greatest threats to the well-being of America is the Judeo-Christian heritage. That's what he said, of giving things to people who have not earned them. Now, aside from the content, just the happening that we are at a place in American society where a public official can risk that. Well, it was in Texas. I think that Nelson Rockefeller is no mean theologian. And he understands that finally, the scandal of the gospel calls the present order of the city into question. And it threatens the city. And it has in it the power to dismantle the way the city is organized. And I am not very different from Nelson Rockefeller, except for a few hundred million. But I am like him in having been seduced by the same way, so that my hardness of heart prevents me from understanding the miracle of the bread. And the world hunger problem will not be solved by hard-hearted people. I do not want to be romantic, but the world hunger problem will only be solved by people who are in the wilderness bread. Now there are a couple other texts that I want to refer to, and then I will quit. Our first worship service, Professor Tielecki had selected, I presume, this text from Matthew about do not be anxious. And the Lucan version of that in Luke 12 has a strange juxtaposition of three motifs. One is anxiety, and one is covetousness, and one is little faith. And they are together in the text, and I know they are together in my life, and I believe they are together in the city. The city is the place of inordinate anxiety, and the city is the place of inordinate coveting, and the city is the place of little faith. And the question for people who eat wilderness bread is how we cut through that cycle. The other text that I want to mention to you that you know very well is in 2 Corinthians 8. Where Paul refers to Exodus 16 and the miraculous distribution of bread in the wilderness. He ends that paragraph by saying that some gathered little and some gathered much and all had enough. But there are two other things in the text that interest me and that pain me. One is, he says about this, that for the sake of equality, you must share your bread that way. I'll just say that to you in case any of you are still into social action stuff. There it is. But the other text, which surely must haunt us, is a Christological affirmation set in the context of the manna, which says that though he was rich, for our sakes he became poor. And I wonder if that is a word to the church at the boundary about how to be faithful in the city. I don't know what it means to be poor. I do not want to make an economic statement, nor do I want to rationalize by saying, well, he means poor in spirit. But if we are to engage in any discipleship of Jesus Christ, we must ponder what it means that though he was rich, he became poor, that others might become rich. That has to do with our affluence, that has to do with our production and consumption, that has to do with our hardness of heart and our inability to understand the bread. Now I have said simply three things to you, that the city wants us to forget, and we go to the boundary so that we see the whole picture of who our mothers and fathers have invited us to be. I've said, secondly, that we are insane, and the vision and the voice at the boundary invite us to a scandalous, radical notion of sanity. And now I have said that the city seduces us into apathy where we can conjure no passion for anything, and we have no capacity to care or to feel or to suffer or to die. And at the boundary, the gift of pathos is available to us. I understand that I have spoken to you in very impressionistic ways. I have said things to you that I think are faithful to the text, but I do not know what they mean. But I have no doubt about the urgency of the ministry. I have no doubt about the urgency of the ministry, not only for the sake of the church, but for the survival of God's creation that has taken the form of the city. And I submit to you, brothers and sisters, that we must pray for each other. And the last comment I want to make to you is my gift of a jar of manna to you. And I hope it will trigger you to locate some jars of manna that you will want to share. Over at the fireside last night, the question was asked about who had been formative in my life, and I said, my father. My father, until about 1955, never earned more than $1,200 a year, and money was very scarce in our family. I went to a very small high school. I mean small, there were 11 boys. There were 16 girls. And the only sport we ever played was basketball, and we played it year-round. And every boy in the high school was on the team, wasn't terribly competitive. I was number 10. My good friend was number 11 because he had a bad heart. But he dressed every game. Now, we played small high schools, but there were none as small as ours, and all of them were bigger than us, and most of them beat us all the time. And the jocks in our town thirsted for victory. And I remember one night they said to us, we had to play Frank McGraw's team. Frank McGraw was the county school superintendent and a coach who in his gym ran the clock. And so the jocks said, if you beat Frank McGraw's team, we'll give you $1 a point for every point you beat them by for food after the game. And I don't know what happened, but we beat them by 37 points. And they nearly fed us till we wanted no more. Now, my dad didn't come around that night. He knew it was an evening for the jocks. But my dad, out of his income, every night we lost, which was almost every night, brought a case of Coke to the locker room. And the jocks were not there. And a bottle of Coke is a jar of manna to me. Not because God loves losers. You know, Mark Spitz's father said when he won 7 medals, God loves a winner. That's got nothing to do with it, because my father didn't care about winning and losing. He really cared, in the best way he knew how, about the crisis of the human spirit. And us who are entrusted with ministry have inordinate opportunities to locate the crisis of the human spirit and to discern in the midst of it small pieces of manna that can be put in jars for our sons and daughters. And if we will permit them, they have the power to transform the city that is promised to us.